solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
I went once to a public sector company and they had this Krishna poster with Arjun and his finger pointing. And I'm like, why is Krishna finger pointing? Because in people's head, a coach is a teacher. Like, because they have this teacher, headmistress is going to beat them up and tell them do the right thing. There is no right thing. The coach enables you to see parts of yourself even you don't know exists. He helps you understand, see the limitations that you have. It helps you understand that what are the kinds of people you need around you to create a complementary team to the context you are in. How to deal with the fact that you are not the smartest guy in the world. Or you may have been the smartest guy, but in the next situation, you may not be the smartest guy. How do you deal with uncertainty? How do you deal with the fact that you are a power-hungry monster who calls himself a leader? A teacher has to tell him that. Now, he can't tell, right? You can't tell this. I deal with so many powerful people who have a very low self-esteem about them. All they want to hear is good things. So they hire coaches to tell them how great they are.
Welcome to the fourth conversation in 2018 and the 25th conversation at the Play to Potential podcast, a series of reflective conversations with accomplished individuals across various fields on three broad themes: leadership, transitions, and careers. I'm your host, Deepak Jayaraman. I'm an executive coach, and I work with leaders and organizations and help them play to their potential by engaging with them during periods of high-stakes transition, personal and organizational. You could visit transitioninsight.com for more details. If you're new to the podcast and want to get a sense of the nature of the content that's covered here, you might want to go to YouTube and type Play to Potential Highlights from 2017. I've tried to capture the key takeaways from our various conversations last year with leaders across disciplines, from people such as Amish Tripathi, Zia Modi, Nanda Nilekani, Vishy Anand, Vijay Amritraj, Avnish Bajaj, Vinita Bali, and the like. My guest this time is Devdutt Patnaik, a well-known mythologist, author, illustrator, and speaker. He writes on relevance of mythology in modern times, especially in areas of management, governance, and leadership. He's an author of 30 books and 600 columns and has been a TED speaker in 2009. His TV shows include Business Sutra on CNBC TV18 and Devlok on Epic TV. He consults organizations on culture, diversity, and leadership, and also consults various television channels and filmmakers on storytelling. In our conversation, we spoke about how some of his formative experiences, especially while studying medicine, have held him in good stead in his career in mythology. He also spoke about how he transitioned from the world of medicine and healthcare, where he spent 15 years, to mythology when he joined Future Group as the Chief Belief Officer. In our podcast, we also spoke about his perspectives on what it takes to flourish in the gig economy and spend time talking about the distinction between the Western paradigm and the Indian paradigm when it comes to topics around leadership and coaching. Just a quick note on how you could access the content at playtopotential.com. You could either listen to the full conversation or a particular nugget. If you're more interested in multiple perspectives that are curated by key themes, you could access the specific nuggets at playtopotential.com and navigate through any of the tags along which the content is organized. Without further ado, over to the conversation with Devdutt. Devdutt, thank you so much for your time. Excited to be talking to you.
Hello.
And a good place to start maybe is to get a quick sense of what your pie chart of time looks like today. What do you do, and more importantly, why do you do what you do?
Well, about 50% of my time goes in traveling and lecturing. Mm-hmm. And the remaining 50% of my time is in writing. So lecturing includes consulting work,
sure.
But that's 50% of my time, and 50% of my time is writing, lecturing, conceptualizing. Mm-hmm. So that's how it goes. So that's broadly my day, always.
Mm-hmm. And has that evolved significantly ever since you moved out on your own? Has that pie chart shifted significantly over time?
Well, earlier it used to be 80% of the time I used to do a work, I used to do a job.
Right.
And I had only 20% time of writing.
Mm-hmm.
Now I have more time to write, but my travel has increased. So the 50% of the time I used to just go to an office and come back. But even then I used to travel for tours. But my travel time, I think that has taken a bit of more toll. I would like to reduce that, but you can't teleport yourself.
Fair enough. Fair enough. And one thing I'm curious about is to what extent people's formative years have informed who they are and how that sort of shows up even later years. Do you have a view on, let's say, how much of who you are was baked in the early years?
Well, I think you figure it out yourself. I think my science background helps me in being organized and systematic. But then I speak to my school teachers who say I was organized and systematic even when I was a child, which I have no memory of. Mm-hmm. I thought I was disorganized, but for them I was highly organized. So I guess that part has always been with me. I still think I'm disorganized, but all my friends think I'm highly organized. So that's, you know, your perception. What do you know and what do others think? Okay. You know, so there's a vast difference between that. I think it's also about asking questions. I don't take answers for granted. And I've always been suspicious of simple answers. I like to know go deeper into figuring out what do people actually mean when they say something. And I think that is a very important part of my work when somebody says, and because especially in the management world, everybody uses jargon. But many of the time they don't know what they mean. And even if they know what they mean, they're using it strategically, not because they genuinely mean it. You know, so empowerment is a word that will be used by people who do not give power at all. But that's the right word to say in a public forum. And I hear it all the time. You know, I see it in amongst bureaucrats, politicians, corporate sector workers. So that is something that very early in life, I would always ask very fundamental questions. And I think many children do, but it's just that I sort out the answers. Many people sort of wait for answers to come to them. Especially in certain fields, I think science background helps you a lot because I was studying medicine and I had very good teachers who told us to study medicine in a particular way. And I think I applied just that principle in other aspects of my life. That same principle. I saw it as a principle, not as just to study anatomy and physiology.
When you see medicine in a particular way, can you double click on that?
Textbooks never tell you why. They tell you how and what and how mostly. So anatomy is what and physiology is how. So if you ask how is your eye, the anatomy of the eye will tell you how is the eye designed, and the physiology, how does it work? It doesn't tell you why the head eye is located in that particular location. Why is the eye not located behind your head? Why is it round? Why is the eyeball a ball and not a square? Those questions are not asked. And the teachers would explain how this is an evolutionary process. It's something that started like this. It started here. And this was part of the tutorials. Never part of any text. It's still not any part of any textbooks. It's people who have sort of joined the dots and explained things. As why do you have one mouth and not five mouths? And how does it work? Because there are insects with many eyes and multiple mouths. And so why are humans the way we are? What happens when we stand on 2 feet? What happens to the backbone? So the why part of it, which is not taught in anatomy and physiology textbook, is something that, and it helps you, and it happened in the later years because they would tell you, read between the lines, read between the lines, read between the lines. And I had 3-4 teachers, I remember, telling me these things, that, you know, why is the carotid artery designed in a particular way? And you realize that we used to just memorize it and get the full marks. So we had full marks. We were the best students sitting in front. But we never ask you, why does this artery have more musculature and that artery does not have much musculature? We never ask the why questions. And the best teachers in medicine would always ask why. And I think that was medicine. But when I applied in the corporate, I would hear words like strategy. And I said, why is somebody doing strategy? I remember once, much later in life, when I was in front already, and I asked a person who was talking on leadership, a very senior person, so why do you want to be a leader? And he just said, oh, nobody asked this question. We just assume everybody leadership is good. He said, why? And the why questions made many people uncomfortable. And I remember him telling me that, you're writing on leadership, just pick up textbook on leadership, take the table of contents and work on it. I'm saying, why is the table of contents there? Why is this the first chapter and not the second chapter? Even today, even graphic design, people, when you're writing, people don't know, when do you use a bullet point? When do you use numbering? They're two different ideas. When do you use bold? When do you use italics? When do you use color? Everything has a reason. If you're seeing design,
Why is a book designed in a particular way? So you see badly designed posters. You walk into, you see these, when, for example, you see the government offices and you see the posters and you realize they're bad posters and you realize it reflects on a poor intellectual base, extremely poor. And you look at private offices and some are good, some are bad, some are over dramatic, some are using rubbish because nobody asked the question why. And the leader is too proud to say he doesn't know. And this is very evident when you start thinking in a particular way. And this thinking came to me from the medical college, not even from school, it's from medical college.
Very interesting. And maybe bridging that world and the world you operate in today, Devdutt, you were in healthcare advisory and then you were in a corporate context. Again, without getting into the specific detail, I'm curious about how you got here. Again, if you could give us a sense of what were the key inflection points and what were some of the choices you made?
See, I didn't really create this journey. This journey happened. I took advantage of every opportunity that came my way. So I was just a medical graduate who didn't want to practice clinical medicine. I didn't know what to do. You'd earn a living, right? You're a middle class family. Your family is anxious. Your father is retired. How do you earn money? And I was good at communication. One thing led to the other and I was in what is called medical communication, writing pamphlets. I didn't realize it was a big thing at that time. I would do it very casually, you know, and I had 8-10 clients and I was, now when I think of it, I had already a consultation in the very early days, but at that time nobody told me it was a big thing. I just had to do it because I had to earn money. And I met the right people who taught me how to write better, senior people. I was just lucky. But they always knew I had this interest in mythology and they used to find it amusing and we used to have these conversations about it. You know, I joined the healthcare pharma industry for 15 years. I'm doing this in the free time. I'm writing my mythology. I was writing my mythology and somebody just told me, hey, you know, somebody wants to publish a book. Would you like to publish a book? So I didn't look for a publisher. A publisher came to me.
And was it grounded in childhood?
No, it was post-medicine. It was something that usually in the later part of the medical, I would say post-medicine completely. I used to read broadly philosophy, religion, but this mythology as a word actually emerged only in the late 90s. I used the word mythology for the first time, very technically, and I was obsessed with defining it, and nobody was defining it correctly for me. So this, you know, this completely zeroing on mythology happened only in 95-96. Until there was this vague thing, spirituality, religion, philosophy, where I used to go and pick up my books and sure. Used to excite me. So it was very vague. But really my journey is because series of, you know, opportunities coming my way. You know, the right person who helps me write medical literature. Then I get a publisher who published my books. And I've published my first book 20 years ago. And he kept publishing my books, but it was not doing well. That time nobody read mythology at that time. So I had to keep doing my manage. And then, you know, I joined the pharmaceutical industry. And when I joined the pharmaceutical industry, I was doing very well because, you know, you're smart. I today realize that I am a systems thinker. I think patterns. But that time I didn't know that. So I could take any job and I would like very fast. So I was like one of those rapid risers, much loved by the directors, not loved by the juniors. Because you're thinking too fast for them and you're figuring it out very rapidly. And I remember some people saying, "This is, you're meant to be a consultant. You can work anywhere." I didn't understand what is consultant. I never heard this word. And then I heard auditors. What are auditors? And what are business? I had never heard these words, right? I'm entering a corporate world. And I would read up on them. What is this? So this was all very organic. Until one day, in this organicness, I used to give these casual lectures with a friend of mine on mythology in Bombay University. Some people in advertising knew me a lot. There were people who read my books in advertising. Santosh Desai, for example, knew me many, many years ago, long before I was popular. And he used to always like me and used to spend a lot of time with me. He writes Times of India, some of the most complex articles in City, City, Bang, Bang. But, you know, to give you a sense of, sure. There were people who knew, but they were like this tiny segment. And then you're introduced one day to Kishore Biyani of the Future Group and he thinks you have value and he tells you to do it full time. Now this, I didn't plan it. It happened. You know, so that's, these things happen, you know, and or TED happens to me because somebody says, wants to do TED in India. I've never heard TED in my life until I went to the venue. I didn't know how important or big it was. I just knew, they said, you know, we want something in mythology. And everybody they met kept saying, there's this guy called Devdutt Patnaik. So the lady met me. I said, okay. And I thought, oh my God, why am I going to Mysore to talk for 15? And 18 minutes, I got very angry. What is this nonsense? This is not the way you can teach this.
This is 2009.
It is 2009. So I had no clue there's something called TED. You know, I'm doing my own thing. I have already written 5-6 books at that time. Not 5-6 books, I think 10 books by that time. But it's not popular in the popular sense, the way it is popular today.
Sure.
So it's very organic. So TED happens, and then Menaka Doshi walks into my Future Group offices and tells that, you know, we want to do a show on Business Sutra. I don't think she was also sure what she wanted. And I said, you know what, I'm very interested in business and management, because by then I had a very good understanding of business, and I saw that the dissonance with modern, with India, complete dissonance, complete and utter dissonance. Today, I realize that there's a problem with management. It's a thing. I think everybody in the world is questioning modern management. You know, what is the, this entire models are being questioned. This growth model is being questioned. We are hurtling towards a disaster. But that time I sensed it intuitively because the patterns were not matching. And I was like, there's something. And when I would use these words, nobody's educated around you. So they're looking at you like, who's this? So they used to like, hey, Ramayana Mahabharata story bolta hai. Which was fine because it helped me earn money. But I knew that this is just the tip of the iceberg. And I had seen, you know, now I realize that, you know, you have to see things before others and then show it to them and be patient. And I've been lucky in that journey that I've just got the right people. And then, you know, Amish Tripathi happened. And a lot of the rings happened, and everybody started.
The category grew. Right?
Category grew without me doing anything, and then suddenly people realized, okay, that's entertainment and fiction, but there's something deeper. You know, so 80% of my readers are interested in the entertainment part of it, but there are 20% who are like, hey, there is something more here, which everybody in India knows, right? We all know that there's a lot of wisdom in India, but we've never articulated it.
Right.
And the Gurujis articulate it. And today when I was thinking, I was to read the Gurujis and I was like, oh my God, so wise man. And today I'm realizing, no, fault in thinking, you know, because now this is the science coming back to you and saying, why are they saying these words and where are these words coming from? And then you read postmodernism. That was a very important part of post-structuralism, philosophy, literature. You start studying other things as a free reading in order to understand mythology. And you start questioning Western understandings of the subject. You start questioning the best minds in the world because you start saying, hey, what is their prejudice? There's no, you know, unlike material science, where prejudice doesn't really exist or exists in a very insignificant way, the human sciences or the social sciences are full of bias.
Right.
You can't, like, Amartya Sen cannot talk without bias, however hard he tries. He has data, but how you read a data is based on bias. Now, these are things that you only learn, not in medicine, because in medicine, clinical medicine is full of bias, but pure medicine, which is anatomy, physiology, pharmacology, cannot have bias. It's just data. The moment human beings come, so you apply the same principles, and that's what I sort of, and that happened over time, and then it's organic, right? So till what, 2007, I'm still in the pharma industry. It's only after 2007. So literally it's 10 years now where I am doing my own thing. I mean, I was officially employed with companies, but the private understanding was I will be on my own and I'll do my own thing.
And having, again, plotting this journey from being employed in organizations with, you know, sort of well understood job descriptions to being on your own, what's been your learning in terms of being credible, if I may use the term, gig economy, where you build a certain brand for yourself and then people reach out to you and then you add value. What are some of the principles that people should bear in mind to operate credibly in this space?
If you want to understand gig economy and you are not embarrassed by things, you should understand a sex worker. And that sounds very awful, but market is you're selling yourself. Who has been selling themselves for centuries? What is the world's oldest profession? So I always tell people in the old days, and of course, when we think of sex, we have these, you know, very Brahminical, puritanical notions of it. But honestly, this is just a service providers, and they were providing a particular kind of service. And there is demand and there is supply. And it's the same thing. You have to just think demand and supply. If there is no demand, there is no supply. And how does, in a crowded market of suppliers, does one supplier become more popular than the other? And in the old days, the women only had their voice. They didn't have anything. So they would sing. So if you see some of the old Hindi movies, they'll show this hero walking down, suddenly hears somebody sing and he goes to that house. It's exactly how you function. You have to reach out to people. If you don't sing, nobody's going to come to your kota. Now, when I say this, it sounds awful.
I get the principle.
Yeah, but I'm very clear that I use this word often and people get very upset. I say, tab aaya food. You're a service provider. Service provider, and you have to learn from them. You have to learn, and if you read the scriptures, the shastras are very clear. And there are the devadasi, the ganika, must never get attached to the client. And the client only cares for them as long as they're beautiful. And that's a clear relationship. So don't fall in love with your client, because the client is going to abandon you one day and go over to the other. So you have to keep working hard to be worthy of it. And if you understand this, you understand business so well. You understand market and supply. You see, in India, what's the Hindi word for marketing?
I was going to say Bechna, but Hindi is not my mother tongue.
No, but generally it's Bazaru. Bazaru is a bad word in India. You think of the market. This is the old feudal economies. In India, we look down on the market. We were feudal. We lacked the land. Jameen kiska hai? So we didn't think in terms of demand and supply. Market is about demand and supply. So we actually look down upon someone who sells his wares. Baniya hai. These are all bad words in India. This shows our Brahminical feudal mindset. This kind of a... nobody's thinking economics, right? If you read Arthashastra, Arthashastra is very clear. Demand and supply, controlling the market. Chanakya has no qualms. He's ruthless about it. There's a vast difference between Manusmriti and Chanakya Arthashastra. And we don't understand that our systems in India are based on economics. But we were somewhere embarrassed by economy, somewhere along the line. Something happens in India and we look down on money, although we secretly want money, which is because you are not recognizing the value of Lakshmi. And whenever you do that, Lakshmi will play her games and she will mess with you. And I think it's all, ultimately, there is a phrase in the scriptures, the Rishi will always want a cow. Godan, he'll always go to the king and say, give me a cow. Cow means a livelihood. If anybody thinks the cow means a real cow, then he's an idiot. Because when I have a cow, I have milk, so I have food, I have dung, so I have fuel. And also the dung was used in the old days to make your house, right? So effectively, a man with a cow is autonomous. He doesn't depend on anyone for his survival, which means now he can focus on the stars and if he wants to study the stars and write on Jyotisha Shastra, or he wants to study Vastu Shastra, anything he wants to study, he can do whatever he wants because he doesn't have to think about his hunger. Because every few hours he'll be hungry, he'll need food. At night he'll need to sleep, he'll need shelter. The king gives him a cow. This is something that people don't understand. This India understood, Godan Karo, create livelihood, is what it means. It's a metaphor. So I think people who want to become independent, first I always tell that how is going to pay your bill? Because there are only two or three ways in which you can pay your bill. You inherit fortune, somebody pays for you, so you're rich family, so you can. And I always wonder why rich people work. I think they're fools. Of course they give these stupid reasons like, oh, I'm ambitious and all that. Most of them are doing rubbish. 90% of the rich people I know are doing work which can be outsourced to someone else. They are not necessary. So go enjoy your life. They can't. Because there's something else, the issue, right? Which they don't want to deal with. Second, if you're not rich, then you work for someone, somebody will give you money. So then you become a supplier of service. Supplier of service basically means Shudra. That is the meaning of the word. So in Chanakya Arthashastra, it says, if you want to create a large village, get Shudras in it. So he doesn't see Shudra the way the puritanical views are. It is service providing. You provide service and you get, or you create a product. You create a product. The third is that you generally are an entrepreneur. You create, you have a business of your own. So entrepreneur ho, ya the service provider ho, ya inheritor ho. These are the three options that you have. And if you're not, you have to be in one of the three. You decide where you want to be. The toughest is to be the entrepreneur because there's nobody to fall back on. But it's also liberating because you're free and you get a lot of other benefits. So the rishis were entrepreneurs, but they're dependent on that cow. So they had to do work which didn't really create immediate value. So they depended. So I always tell people, Gomata hai kya tumhare paas? Do you have a source of income? And you can reduce your needs. But if you don't have a source of income, don't think of the gig economy. Because you will starve. And it's romantic to talk about starvation, but you have to pay your bills. So I'm very clear about that. I said, if you don't have
sort of a steady cash flow to take care of the basic needs.
Yeah, and see, Lakshmi is something that people forget, that even in the Shramana Paramparas, the monastic orders of India, whether it is the Buddhism or Jainism, the first goddess to be worshipped is Lakshmi. The first goddess whose images are carved is Lakshmi, not Saraswati, Lakshmi. So these people were not, they were recognizing the value. It is only our country, somewhere along the line, we decided to make Bazaru, Baniya, these negative words. And we have to rediscover it through colonialism. Because we never understood the importance of money, because we were living these Rajas, whether the Mughals also, they just became landowners and they were enjoying money and they were spending time, you know, inheritors. They were inheritors of wealth and power and they had service providers taking care of them. So they forgot to create enterprise. So here you have the Portuguese coming, the Arabs coming, doing trade, and you are like not thinking. And there were members of the royal family. If you read about the Mughal, you know, I just read recently a history book which says that Jodhabai, whom we know as Jodhabai, we show her as this romantic thing in Bollywood films, but she was actually an investor in huge businesses in the Mediterranean Sea. And she had ships. She owned ships, so which means they were thinking business. But it was never given the respect. We never realized the value of trade. We looked down on trading. We didn't allow people to travel across the sea. You know, we became this closed set and the power became about land, power became about caste, not about money.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. Just a quick comment. It's interesting to contrast this with the transition of Amish Tripathi, who after going to IIM Calcutta, pursued a career in financial services for several years before switching to writing. In Amish's case, the seeds of transition were possibly sown in his growing up years in terms of the dinner conversations that would happen at home.
The seeds are to be found perhaps in an incident that happened 11-12 years ago when my family and I, we were watching TV and we discovered something interesting and a philosophical discussion ensued. And that was the genesis of the Shiva trilogy. It was a philosophical discussion into the nature of evil.
Okay.
My grandfather was a pandit in Kashi. Both my parents are deeply religious, so we have an atmosphere in our family of of our myths, of our scriptures, of discussions, debates on it. In our family, we also read a lot. Everyone reads a lot.
Devdutt, on the other hand, talks about getting into mythology much later, but the seeds of inquiry being sown during the days in medicine, thanks to some of his teachers. I think what's common, however, is that this transition is often an organic process and not a magic switch. It's important to realize that as we think about transitions. Both these individuals had arguably already gathered significant expertise and market recognition before they left the previous orbit, whether it was Amish leaving IDBI Federal or Devdutt leaving Future Group. When I asked Amish about when he quit his banking job, this is what he said.
It was a pragmatic decision. Look, I come from a middle class family, okay? So I always joke ki bhai mere paas baap dada ka aashirwad hai, jaidad kuch nahi. So I have to be pragmatic and practical in my career decisions. I have responsibilities. I'm blessed with a child, I have a wife. So I resigned only after my second book, when my royalty check became greater than my salary check.
Devdutt continued to have a career in the pharma industry at least for about a decade before he committed to mythology as a direction. I mention this because several people quit their jobs and start going after their passion from ground zero, and that can be a really, really tricky proposition because that doesn't guarantee cash flows. And the lack of cash flows can sometimes really come in the way of having fun in what you thought might be fun. If you find the conversation purposeful, do rate and review on iTunes. It will help others discover the podcast and seek value from it. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Devdutt. And just moving on to some of the insights on elements of leadership, Devdutt. I was reading one of your works, and you talk about people transitioning through different roles as they go through life. Parshuram, that is rule follower, to Ram, that's being a role model, to Krishna, being a coach. And then eventually Buddha or Kalki. I found that quite revealing. So I'm curious about two things. One is, again, if you could expand on these two for the purpose of listeners. But more importantly, how should people transition effectively from one to the other? I'm curious about that inflection point when they move from one to the other.
See, transition has, one has to be very clever, one has to be very clear what transition means. In the Western model, it is a relay race. You give up something to become something. But the Indian model is you build on what is there. So it is not A and then give up A and become B and then give up B and become C. It is A plus B plus C.
Interesting. Could you talk about these for a minute
Ram does not exclude Parshuram.
Interesting.
And Krishna doesn't exclude Ram and all. But that's how we are thinking. Even when today people talk about change management, they talk of change as replacement. They don't talk of change as expansion. So they think of, I'll tell you, and this comes from the Western mindset. The book has to be replaced by a new book. They are not saying a new book has to be added to the bookshelf.
Interesting.
So the Western model classically is replace the book with a new book. So it is in a religious framework also. One religion is replaced by the other. That's how they think of religion and ideology. It is a Western mind and it can, nothing you can do about it. Of course, they'll deny it vehemently. But they can't handle. So they were Greco-Romans. When they became Christian, they gave up their Greco-Roman traditions. Then they became secular, they gave up Christianity. I mean, because they can't handle two books simultaneously. Indian model of leadership is to move towards an infinite database with more and more data. As you grow, your database increases. So you have can handle more and more. So you have to increase your RAM and your application abilities and the ability to handle more and more information. That is growth. It is not giving up one database. It's not moving from one equipment to the other, but it is expanding your equipment. And this notion, this very simple idea is lost. So just become a leader. So if you become the leader of a company, it doesn't mean you can't still do the doorman's job. You have to be able to do the doorman's job and a little bit more. This is how God is described in India. He's everything and a little bit more. So it is that. Here it is. That's why everybody, like I see these very rich people and their children suddenly think that they'll get the wisdom of their parents and their grandparents through osmosis. And on day one, they're made to sit in the head office. And they talk to seniors as if, because inheritance gives them the authority to talk to you as an equal. And I have done this and I've seen these children stepped out of international American schools, talking in an American accent, knowing nothing about India, talking to you as an equal because they have a bigger wallet. And I'm like, are they idiots or their parents idiots? And they're going to give this entire fortune to this idiot. But you can do nothing about it because they're so dumb. And that is the biggest discovery, that large wallet size doesn't mean that you're not dumb. Because you're a fool. He's the blessed with inheritance. But he still has to go through the entire thing. That is why in Ramayana, Ram has to go to the forest. Vishwamitra drags Ram into the forest and says that, what is this palace? Vasishtha is teaching you in a safe ecosystem. Palace is a safe ecosystem. Come to the forest. Can you fight the Rakshasas? That's a training going on. Go kill. Save this lady. This is practical when Vishwamitra is taking him through the jungle. What is the jungle? Jungle is a metaphor for the market. It's very nice to sit in the fathers and say, I'm the head of marketing. Chaka bechna. Sell yourself. Sing in the streets and let's see how many, you know, men will come to you. When you learn that way, it is the brutal thing. You see this in airports, right? You'll see this credit card, these young MBA guys trying to sell credit cards. It's very shameful and you can see their awkwardness. But you have to do it. You come down to the ground and then you learn 1 year that and then you learn to be a manager. See, you're blessed. Your roller coaster ride is up there, but you have to spend time on the shop floor. This is many old families I still see doing that. I know some of the families where for the first 10 years, the children are not allowed to sit in the board meetings. No chance you're sitting in the board meeting. You will have to spend 10 years, because what's the hurry? The father is still the MD or chairman, right? You are not going to become MD and chairman. In fact, they are encouraged to do business and they are allowed to fail in the business. So they learn how brutal the world is, that uncle will not help you. Auntie won't help you. You can't pick up the phone to the bank and get a loan.
And in the journey, I'm specifically curious about the Ram to Krishna role modeling to being a coach. Again, when you work with leaders, what are your observations on people that sort of move to the next level effectively?
See, I think many people glamorize Krishna a lot. And one has to be very careful because as Indians, we are seeing, there is a religious tradition associated with these guys, right? And Ram is seen as some kind of a school head coach and Krishna is seen as who helps you win the battle. So you are really hiring coaches to tell you, give me the secret formula so I can win the battle. Krishna is not doing that. And you have to understand what is Krishna doing repeatedly. The Pandavas win the war. You have to see the story carefully. He's enabling them to grow up. In the Pandavas, when they go into the forest, again the forest again, the Kauravas, the Pandavas lose the kingdom and they go to the forest and they spend a whole year as servants. That is Krishna training them. Because in the entire Mahabharata, they're kings and suddenly one day they have to be servant. How does it feel? How does it feel for a king to be servant for a day? And he slapped. Yudhishthira is slapped in Virata Parva. And Draupadi is sexually abused. And Arjun is treated like a girl. She's a Brahmala. She's a eunuch. So treated as an object, a sex object. These are psychological narratives which we don't think about. So the Krishna is actually, you know, I went to once to a public sector company when they had this Krishna poster with Arjun and his finger pointing. And I'm like, why is Krishna finger pointing? Because in people's head, a coach is a teacher. Like, because they have this teacher, headmistress is going to beat them up and tell them do the right thing. There is no right thing. The coach enables you to see parts of yourself even you don't know exists. He helps you understand, see the limitations that you have. It helps you understand that what are the kinds of people you need around you to create a complementary team to the context you are in. How to deal with the fact that you are not the smartest guy in the world. Or you may have been the smartest guy, but in the next situation, you may not be the smartest guy. How do you deal with uncertainty? How do you deal with the fact that you are a power-hungry monster who calls himself a leader? A teacher has to tell him that. Now, he can't tell, right? You can't tell this. I deal with so many powerful people who have a very low self-esteem about them. All they want to hear is good things. So they hire coaches to tell them how great they are.
Talking about coaches, in your opinion, what are the few things that differentiate the great coaches from the average ones?
The students. It is a student who makes the difference. There are no great teachers in the world. There are great students who know how to use a teacher. That is the whole thing. It is the student who makes the difference. Who is able to look at the teacher and figure out, okay, what can I take from him? And therefore limited by his own curiosity and ambition. You should know, it's like consulting. I have seen most CEOs don't know how to use consultants. What is the purpose of having a consultant in your office? Many people don't know. They just do it because that's what is to be done. And by the time you discover the real purpose of it, it's too late. You have moved on your career-wise. And that's one of the reasons why you have many advisors, senior advisors. Senior advisors are there to tell you, why do you hire a big consulting firm? This is the how we show the consult coaches are not doing and you can blame the student, of course, but that is the relationship where you know the teacher, the student allows the teacher to be the teacher. And the teacher allows the student to be the student. And this is always a relational thing. Guru Shishya Parampara is not the guru is power and guru Shishya as the powerless and recipient of the knowledge. No, the student ignites in the teacher the right questions. It's a complex process of learning.
It's not a linear, what you're saying.
It's not linear at all. It's this, I will have knowledge, I will give you knowledge. It is never that. And we are thinking like that. It is not like that at all. When I'm coaching, I look at the person in front of me and I'm giving him a framework. And I see what he wants. And most of the time, they're telling, tell me a trick so I can make more money. Teach me a trick. I'm a pony, teach me a trick. And I'm like, if I knew the trick, why would I teach you? I would have been doing business. No. And I suddenly realize, oh my God, I'm dealing with a very foolish person. And I try to explain in many, many metaphors that, you know, this is what we have to work together. I have a body of knowledge that nobody else has access to. And there's a lot of knowledge in this access, in this knowledge. But you have to help me pull it out for you. I have access. I bring the database with me. Sure. But you have to help me pull it out from here.
Right, the query function, right?
Yeah, I can't do that because otherwise I would be the businessman. No, I would be sitting in the business.
I would be sitting in the throne. I'm not sitting on the throne for a reason. Those who sit on the throne will not have the able to do this. So Ram, after that, Krishna is a charioteer. Nokare. Nokar. He's not king. Although he's wearing crown and all that, which we get confused. He's a gwala, cowherd. He's a low caste man. But we don't want to use, because it's our Brahminical not letting us see data. Ram is Pattabhishekham. He is sitting on the throne. He is auspicious. So Ram, what will happen when Krishna and Rama are having a conversation? What will happen? You just have to see Vashishtha, you have to see Vishwamitra and see the conversation, and you'll understand what's going on. Or how the rishis would teach or talk to the kings. They would talk very differently.
Devdutt, the other piece I'm curious about, I was reading your book, My Gita, and I love the distinction you make between the notion of focus and perspective. And specifically, in the Indian education system, where often there's an emphasis on knowing the answer and solving, let's say, closed-ended problems. Yeah. Again, for people that are brought up with a dosage of focus, how do they move to a world where they build perspective, which is what is often required as they move into leadership roles? What's your take on that?
I think empathy. I think you have to understand, just ask people, how do you earn money? I ask very blunt questions. How will you earn money if I throw you in the market? Just ask this one question. I'll take away your wallet. I'll take away everything and throw you in the market. How will you find your way? That reveals so much. Take away your cell phone. Take away your phone. Tell me how you'll survive. People don't ask fundamental questions. Basic questions. Very, very basic questions. They're too eager. They're so consumed by their vision. This is where some of the American companies are brilliant, but then they work within that American context most of the time. Very few think in the Indian context, but there are many clever guys who take that and adapt it to the Indian context. So, you know, that's a great thing. You know, I always say Uber, Ola is a fantastic thing which has emerged because it created employment for so many people and solved so many problems for us, right? But nobody thought that you could, you know, look at Goa. In Goa, you cannot have Uber and Ola because of a mafia, car mafia, which nobody in India can break. There's a car mafia over there. But, you know, when you're looking at focus and perspective, it basically means moving away from only your assumptions to other people's assumptions. Corporations are always talking about the vision of the corporation. I don't care a damn for the vision of the organization. Shareholders' vision, why do I care for the shoulder? This is a very horrific model in the global scenario where I am giving you service for which you are going to give me a salary. That is the first level. Second, next level I come, I not only give you service, but I also give you, my service could be a sophisticated service, thinking for you. You as an organization, so for thinking you're paying me money. So it's a very clear transaction. I'm not here to, but this whole idea that you exist for shareholder value is a very dangerous Western. It is the dark side of capitalism. It is not healthy capitalism. Healthy capitalism is to create value for everyone, which people use lip service. It's lip service. People don't understand it. And very, 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 very few people understand the value of giving value to everybody. And I think this is what focus to perspective is the ability to move from your needs to other people's needs. So you go to a warehouse of a company and just check where the toilets are. Just ask, who's the lowest person in the office? I ask them to visualize. Where do they stay? What is the person employment? You have 10,000 people working for you, right? Let's put them in categories. Let's look at the lowest category. Let us look at the most unprivileged person in that category. Let's take one person and let's visualize their life. And which part of their life do you intervene in? And suddenly you realize they travel for 2 hours. When they come to office, do they have a place to freshen up? They're going to work for 8 hours for you. Do they have a place to eat? Basic things. How do you train them? How do you enable them to do their job better so you get the best out of them? This visualization, which is very different from the life you are leading in your top chambers, doing it repeatedly as a habit eventually enables you to understand what is going on. Because tomorrow when you're going to fire that person, you know what you're firing. Not because the shareholder wants more profit, but it also demands this ruthlessness because sometimes you have to do it. But empathy is something. We are too busy thinking critical thinking. Perspective is to see the shareholder's value and employee value and customer value, not or. not replace one book with the other, but add a book to the shelf.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. Just a quick comment. One company that I'm reminded of when I hear this from Devdutt is Johnson & Johnson and their credo. It was crafted about 75 years back in 1943. I want to let that sink in for a minute, 75 years back. This was much before anyone had heard the term corporate social responsibility. The credo is a pithy one-page document that basically says that their first responsibility is to doctors, nurses, and consumers that use their products. The second responsibility is towards employees that work with J&J around the world. The third responsibility is towards the communities that J&J is a part of, and to the world community as well. Finally, the fourth responsibility is towards the shareholders. It says that if it did these four things well, it would make a fair profit over the long run. What's impressive is not just the clarity of this document, but the manner in which this pervades various parts of the business, starting from how they recruit, how they manage performance, how they give feedback, the kind of stories they share in meetings, and more. To use Devdutt's words, it boils down to whether you see the world as Ranabhumi or Rangabhumi. If you find the conversation purposeful, do rate and review on iTunes. It will help others discover the podcast and seek value from it. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Devdutt.
Devdutt, I'm also curious about how people build habits. Let's say, building empathy. In your experience, what are the lessons we can learn from mythology, for example, on how we can start building some of the habits we haven't been possibly exposed to in our growing up years?
See, this concept of habits is a Western idea. It comes Indian, habit is a bad word in Indian philosophy. It's a bad word. Therefore, you're continuous. Another word for habit is conditioned. I'm conditioned to do it. Conditioning, that's a Pavlovian response, right? A dog has a habit of salivating whenever the bell rings. And the West has made it a virtue. Action without thought is habit. Repetitive action without thought is habit. And if you look at the many of the cultures in the West, they are like domesticated animals. At a particular time, they'll get up and run. At a particular time, they'll get up. So there is, it's this kind of a, they are on a treadmill all the time. And this is seen as virtue. You know, driving in the car with a coffee in your hand. Nobody sees in America that this is tragedy. It's a tragedy. You can't enjoy your coffee. You can't enjoy your drive. You have glamorized slavery. You have glamorized slavery. And nobody sees it because you are all the Gurujis in their white coats with their chin, the fist on the chin photographs, you know, those photographs that you see are telling you, therefore it must be right. Nobody's questioning, what is the habit? And habit has been somehow projected as a good thing. Indian thought is all about awareness. It's all about awareness. Why are you doing what you're doing? Why are you doing what you're doing? Why are you not doing what you're not doing? And once you're aware, then you realize what is of value to you and what is not of value to you. So you are not in a habit, then breaking habits becomes difficult. And then breaking habit becomes, there are good habits, there are bad habits. Habits are good and bad depending on context. You know, so you will find people behaving in, that's why I always find, you know, when expats come to India, they have a tough time because the habit is suddenly in this new context, they don't know. Because, oh my God, there is no place to run. There is no place to, oh my God, they don't have this thing. Because the habit, right, they become the animal. You have become like an animal. And habit really goes to the lower part of your brain, not the upper part of your brain. And your habit is about avoiding life. You do habits like, it's an addiction.
It's like autopilot.
It's an autopilot. No, and it's addictive. Like I have a habit of writing, but it's addiction. If I don't write, I get withdrawal symptoms, which means I've trained my body to be in pain when I don't do it and to get pleasure when I do it. And I'm not aware of it. I'm just doing it mechanically. So we are an awareness culture. Awareness, 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 not habit culture. Habit culture, empathy goes away. So it's just, you know, you see some of the Western coaches talking and I'm like, it's like the sports coaches. And in India, we don't have a very big sports culture. One of the reasons, because it is about this physical forming thing. And again, the Brahminical thing, it is a very lower end of the spectrum.
And talking about awareness, building awareness, again, Any pointers to how people could go about improving themselves in terms of...
I think observing other people. Observing other people not from as a judge. Many people observe people as a judge. But to recognize with empathy, why is a person doing what he's doing? You know, what does a staff carry at a particular kind of box? How do they carry their food? Why do they carry the food in a particular way? Why do they work a particular set of hours? Why do some people talk more and do less? And then you figure out and you see the dark side of it. And you call it out that I have noticed that you don't seem to be doing the work. And calling out very gently and compassionately, putting them aside and saying that, you know, I see through it. You know, I see through it. So I think it is very important. I personally believe in darshan. Awareness, not self-awareness, but awareness of the other. You see, everybody tells me about Maslow's law. Maslow's law is obsessed with the self. It's all about the self. There is no other. There is no other. And the other is para. Svajiva, parajiva. And from para, you have para, transcendent. From para, you have param, infinite. This consideration for the other does not exist in Western thought. It goes to the point of saying that if I create value for the shareholder, I will create share value for the customer and the employee. And I asked people ultimately, when given a choice, whose value matters? Whose value matters? Given a choice, when you have Sophie's choice, the tough choice, that reveals who you are as a person. And everybody will say, of course it is me. I said, life is, you have decided that. It is not so simple. There are many people in the world who think very differently from you, but you've conditioned yourself into believing.
Let's talk about beliefs, Devdutt. Again, you were the chief belief officer earlier, but even as a coach, one of the things I'm curious about is if somebody has to change their behavior, it's important for us to change their beliefs. So what are your thoughts on changing people's beliefs for them to start behaving differently?
See, belief is really a reflection of insecurity. Fear. You believe in something because you're frightened of something else. And if you understand fear, so really belief is a nice word to understand fear. The moment you handle fear, your belief changes automatically. Child does not want to go to school crying, because it's frightened of the school. I believe the school is a threat. I don't believe the school is an opportunity. Without seeing it also. So the child starts to cry. Parent takes the child to the school. After some time, the child realizes it's not that bad. There is threatening, but there's also opportunity. And the child starts going towards that. And then it gets so attached to the school that it starts crying when it's time to leave the school. So that's the journey what happens with all of us. We believe that our fears, and it's really, you have to do SWOT analysis. What is your strength and weakness? Which basically, and what are your fears? Your fears define the opportunities and threat. And I think the word fear is not, you know, we don't use that in management a lot. But for me, when I talk about belief, I'm really talking about fears. Fear of not being the richest man in the world. Fear of not being the most powerful man in the world. Fear of not being relevant. You know, so many, I keep seeing leaders in positions of power who are terrified, who are doing business, but with no vision in mind. They're still doing what they did 30 years ago. 30 years ago, they wanted to make money. 30 years later, they still want to make money. And it's become a habit. And nobody has called out and said that you're stagnating. You're just making more money. And then they say, oh, but I also do charity. I'm like, no, you're addicted. You've addicted. You have not passed on the whatever skills you have to the next generation and prepared for your mortality. Because he's so addicted. Because addiction does not have to, so he doesn't have to deal with mortality. If tomorrow the great names of India don't and the world don't exist, the world will still continue. But you still have them doing exact, you just check them what they did 20 years ago and what they did today. They were successful 20 years ago. And today also they are successful. But what is if you done differently? I'm doing exactly the same thing in a different scale.
I'm doing exactly, because now it's become a habit, but it's a virtuous cycle, because I'm making money. And you're like, oh my God, you're an idiot. Because you're not aware of your mortality. You're not realizing that one day this has to go away. You're not preparing yourself for mortality. Vanaprastha. Grahastashram is only a particular set of time. So you've made your billion. Achha, after that? And you're still talking the same language. And I see them. And you know, you see them in conferences after conferences after conferences. And you're like, there's no shedding. Because they're still thinking they're not successful. Because according to some Fortune magazine or GQ magazine, they're not successful enough. You know, I don't have my private jet, so I'm not really successful, right? And I'm like, that's the benchmark. Because once you get the private jet, it'll be like, you know, I don't have this.
It's a shifting milepost.
It's just, and you're stuck there. You are stuck. That is this habit, right? Now it's habit. But nobody talks about it as a habit, as a terrible, it's an addiction like cigarette. It's just, you're trapped and you can't get out of it.
And you use the word relevant, staying relevant. What does that word mean to you?
It means being happy in an empty room. If nobody looked at you, will you be happy with yourself? The most terrifying question on earth. Once you get addicted to the claps and the adulation and the adoration and fear. Many people like being feared. Many people who don't think, confuse mistake, respect with fear. So many, many, many people think that the people are frightened of me, therefore they respect me. And they get addicted to that feeling. So they want to frighten more and more people. And then they get addicted, and that's habit. And I think the ability to just know that even if nobody exists, I'm okay with it. Okay. The Rishi again, sitting alone in the forest with his cow. The cow is chomping grass. Is he happy? Because nobody's looking at him. Nobody cares for his knowledge. He's got all this knowledge in front of him. He's been spent whole life in the forest, nobody looking at him. What does he do now? He has to pass it on to a student, and if nobody's interested, what does he do? So the stories are there of the Rishis throwing the palm leaves in the air. So the ability to recognize that in the end, you don't matter. In the infinity. That's why Buddhism came up with an idea of zero. India talked of infinity. In an infinite world, you really, really, this is Indian philosophy in its brutal form. You don't matter. But to render yourself irrelevant consciously and be happy about it. And that's what happens. Your children grow up and they have children of their own. They don't pay attention to you anymore. It's a time to be happy that my time is over now. They have their children. They have their life. I've earned enough. My cows are there. I don't have one cow. Thousands of cows. So milk is assured and dung is assured.
And some cheese and butter.
And some cheese and butter with it. But to know that they don't care for you anymore. And it's okay. That's a great thing. And I don't need them to care for me. I have grown up. And it's okay. That is sannyasa. It's a process. It's a journey.
The other thing you talk about, Devdutt, is Sarpa Drishti and Garuda Drishti. And as CEOs, sometimes you need to balance the short-term priorities and solve for the long-term. What's your take on how they could walk that tightrope?
See, Garuda Drishti, Sarpa Drishti is the same as focus and perspective. No? Sarpa Drishti is focus. Garuda Drishti is perspective. It's the same thing. It's just said differently in a more poetic language. What do you need to do now? What do you need to do in the long-term, short-term and long-term thinking? What do you need to do in this market versus the bigger market? And I think you have to go cyclically. Rhythm is a good word in India. You know, somebody told me the rhythm word comes from the word ritta. Seasons. And it is about seasonality. So Monday, Wednesday, Friday, you do Sarpa Drishti. Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, you do Garuda Drishti. And each one influences the other. And if you keep aware that both are necessary, and both have to be equally done, and both influence each other. They have to influence each other. It's like a churn. The force and the counterforce, they work sequentially and they influence each other.
It's not two discrete buckets.
They're not two discrete buckets and they're not working simultaneously. Then it's a tug of war. It's a tug of war. In tug of war, no churning takes place. I am churning what you have churned. Now that's a different way of looking at the world. It doesn't mean they're a book in the bookshelf. Don't throw the book away. Add a book. So for me, Western thought is a very sacred book But you know how the Western mind reads it? Oh, Devdutt is saying against the West. So replace the Western book with the Indian book. So they are using the Western model for the Indian subject. The Indian model for the Western subject is keep the Western book and add the Indian book. Interesting. And that is something that many people say. Many people say, so why are you against the West? And I'm like, so you know, you're still in the Western mindset. Replace the book. Replace the book.
The other piece I wanted to understand, Devdutt, is this notion of judgment, business judgment, dharam sankat. And again, early in career, the decisions that people have to make are often between right and wrong. And as they grow, it's often between right and right. Mm. So what's your take on leaders building that capability of good judgment?
See, for leaders never take decisions in isolation. They are trapped between shareholders, they're trapped between employees, they're trapped between customers. And it's a question of who matters to them in the end. You know, you can take a very good decision that the shareholder hates. You know, I know public sector bank leaders who have been asked to resign to take a good job because the politician didn't like it. Right? So you take the right decision, but your decision is in an ecosystem of other people who can. So you have to decide what matters to you, your principles, your job. Sometimes your job can go away and you will not do good tomorrow. So sometimes you compromise. And therefore, sometimes leaders are namesake leaders. You should be aware. Many people have faces. In many large companies, the CEO is just a spokesperson for the family. If he recognizes his role, ki really you are not a Kshatriya, you're a Shudra, you're a service provider, you're the face of the company, you're sorted. Because you know that I have to follow the family or get out. But you can't, right? Because then social status of the CEO will go away. And the fabulous things that you get with it and the access to clubs will go away. That matters, no? So you have to know what you are actually doing. What you're actually doing in that job. You know, many, many multinational companies, you are just a service provider. You are not a value creator, although they call you a value creator. And you're certainly not the owner. And by owner, I mean the Kshatriya, the landowner.
Sure.
The Vanik is the market person who is going creating value. And then there's a Shudra who is the service provider. Thinkers don't belong in. You can move anywhere you want. It doesn't matter. We can all think. But it is this access you have to understand.
This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. Just a quick comment. The piece that Devdutt speaks about in the context of knowing your role is such an important one. A similar theme came up when I interviewed Rama Bijapurkar, a consumer insights expert and a board member. She spoke about how some CEOs struggle to adopt the right lens when they take on a board position.
So when you go to non-executive board positions, we find that there is a lot of sympathy for the executive management. Mm-hmm. So we usually find that the board divides up when there are issues, and the executive guys who have been executives mm-hmm. have that whole empathy and sympathy. And so they think their job is to sort of make up for the fact that they weren't protected in their tenures and to be the protector.
I can understand why he or she would.
Yeah, and that, oh, you know, our job here is not to disappoint the management. Whereas I'm saying, you know, if you want acquisition desperately, 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 I still don't have to give it to you. And if you're going to get demoralized, I mean, grow up. Right? Mm. So let's talk about why this is important. But my loyalty is somewhere else. It is not to you. I'm not here to be cheerleader, nursemaid, nappy, coach. I think that's the stuff that executive managers tend to get into. They
it's
get
great
into
insight.
Coaching.
The loyalty towards the management just sort of comes by default.
And
right.
then therefore you're the coach and you're the this person and so on. As compared to saying that all of us on boards are called to make judgment calls. So whatever is your background, you bring your background judgment to make the judgment call, and that's all you should do. And you just make judgment calls for everything that's put in front of you. And these are sins of commission, sins of omission, you know, plans, whatever it is you have to, that's what you have to do.
Like Devdutt says, just being clear about the lens you're going to use in a certain context can be immensely clarifying. If you find the conversation purposeful, do rate and review on iTunes. It will help others discover the podcast and seek value from it. Now, let's get back to the conversation with Devdutt.
And from an entrepreneur's perspective, what have you seen good entrepreneurs do in getting people on board and getting them to be value creators?
You have to clarify that you're creating value for whom. not for yourself, for me, for the company. And you're being hired for a service. This, you know, we make this mistake of not clarifying roles. You are being valued because you bring this beautiful ability to create value. But will you get value out of it is a question, or will I get value out of it? This is never clarified. It's a transaction, right? And many people figure out one day that, oh, he's making money out of my ideas. Why should I give him ideas? I'm not getting a share of the profit. All those questions start emerging when you're very smart. If you're not very smart, it doesn't matter. Then you're exploited, allowing yourself to be exploited. But a leader, and everybody has to understand, entrepreneurs to understand that what is he hiring for? It's not the equality business. It's that, yeah, in the, you know, you have to work together, solve problems. Some people like to work because they get the opportunity to solve problems. That's what they want in life. You know, many businessmen figure that. So hire people who enjoy solving problems, but they're not interested in money. So fine, you give them that opportunity, what they want. So look at what the other wants. And they don't tell it in an interview. You'll figure it out over time.
It goes back to the point about empathy, I guess.
You have to understand what they want in life and give them what they want. And then figure out an ecosystem that you have to continuously think of the other so that he thinks about you. So it's a very clear transaction. I'll take care of you, but you take care of me. This is what I want from you. I want these problems to be solved. There is a lot of uncertainty. I have to handle it. I think this clarity of transaction, that's why I believe in, you know, the Tawaf. It's my beautiful model, because she's going to starve if she does not provide service. She's going to die in the market. The market will continue. The buyers will come. Sellers will replace you. So you have to be aware of the transaction.
The other piece I'm curious about, Devdutt, is this notion of storytelling, which is clearly an important skill for leaders. What advice do you have for them to develop that capability?
I think when you're telling a story, you have to be clear. There are different types of stories. What people want to know is something that it has an emotional wraparound around it. And that is what really storytelling means. Storytelling means turning a hard fact into an emotion through plots and characters. That's all it is. There is an idea for which you need an emotional wrap, around which there are characters and plots. So the character is a patra. And patra in Sanskrit means vessel. Vessel of what? Vessel of emotions. Inside an emotion, so it is like, you know, imagine a vessel which contains a syrupy drink. But what really matters is that there is sugar inside so that it takes care of your low sugar levels. So the entire process is storytelling. So I think you should understand who are you telling the story to, why are you telling the story. Once you understand who, so look at the audience. Who are you telling, why are you telling, and most important, resource. People don't have time. Tell it fast. Many people go telling stories, they build unnecessary details and go on and on and on and on. Tell it fast. Corporate storytelling has to be told within 1 minute. 2 max. That's it. That's the only lesson I have for people. Tell the story fast. And you can only tell the story fast if you know what is the arrow you are shooting. And that, wrap it in emotions and wrap that in plots and characters.
And what's the piece that people find the hardest in sort of building their storytelling capability?
I'm going to too many details. One of the things I discovered, and one of the unique things about my book, which made me famous, is that I pressy everything. So I will not say Lord with lotus-shaped eyes. It doesn't matter to the story. In the Ramayana, Ram's lotus-shaped eyes doesn't make a difference. That is when I'm adoring Ram. So in his adoration of Ram, that eyes matter. In the Ramayana, I'm like, okay, what's the point? What's the point of the story? I'm only worried about the point. If there's no point to the story, don't tell me the story. Because Ram is, yeah, is relevant care. You're a seller, remember? What does the buyer want? Demand, supply. So he has no time. You have to give it him in 2 lines. So I always tell people, tell me Mahabharata in 1 line. And you can say, it's a long story. I say, no, 1 line. Now tell me in 2 lines. Now tell me in 5 minutes. Now tell me in 10 minutes. Same story, you have to repeat it like this. And then they get scared. I said, then you don't know the Mahabharata.
It's a great test of synthesis, right?
Yeah. Do you get it? Samaj mein aaya ki nahi? Like, I'll tell you, I met this very senior economist and I wanted to just... So I said, sir, one word. What's economy? Not even blinking, looks at me and says transaction. And at that moment, I know I'm dealing with a guru. He knows his subject. Not only knows his subject, he's clear enough to articulate it for the other to understand. One is many geniuses are there, but they can't articulate. They can't tell. They can't teach. They are like in their own, they can solve the problem, but they can't teach you to solve the problem. I immediately understand and smiled, and I know this is the person to go to when to understand economics. I'll go to this man. One word. That's genius. That's like reduced it one word.
Dev, the real pleasure talking to you. So much to absorb. This podcast is titled Play to Potential. And it's about helping people to be thoughtful about how they address two questions as they navigate through their life. Where to go and how to grow. So in summary, what would you say for people to play to their potential?
I think you should recognize that you are a seed. Potential means bija. And what the market wants is phala. Now the question is, this is a complex question, because what will you grow to? What kind of tree are you? And what fruit do you bear? And does the market want that fruit? If the market doesn't want the fruit, go to another market. Or figure out a way to change the fruit. But you have to be true to yourself. You are a beej. If you try to work hard to be an apple, because apple sells in the market, but you're actually a mango tree, you'll be in existential crisis all your life. Go to the mango market. And sometimes mango markets are not big. Be happy with it.
Fascinating. Pleasure, Devdutt. Thank you so much for your time.
Hope you found the conversation as purposeful as I did. There were three big takeaways for me in this conversation. First is the distinction between focus and perspective. This is particularly relevant because a lot of us are brought with a strong dosage of the objective truth in fields like medicine, engineering, accounting, etc. And as we go through life, our ability to deal with the subjective world ends up being a bigger and bigger deal. I really like the paradigm of Rangabhumi, where we build empathy and we solve not just for ourselves, but for everyone around, just like how J&J does it with the Credo. Second is a distinction between awareness and habit. Very often I come across leaders with ingrained habits, and they often make a virtue of the habit. The key point to note is that habits are relevant in a certain context, and when that changes, it's critical that we examine our habits to see if they're still fit for purpose. The only watch out is that sometimes our context changes suddenly and we take notice, but sometimes the context shifts slowly and we don't realize it. It's critical that we are mindful of how our situation is changing and to examine if the habits are still relevant so that we avoid the frog in the boiling water syndrome. I have several colleagues from IMA and London Business School who started out their career with 80 or 100-hour work weeks and quickly baked that into a habit or a way of life. In a way, this made a lot of sense at that stage because the learning curve was steep, you built your networks with a great set of people, and there was a low personal cost. But over 20 years, as the learning curve tapers, the personal costs rise, they often don't pause to reflect that the context has changed. That's also because the water temperature has risen very gradually, and they notice the temperature changing till it's quite late. I'm not for a moment saying that people shouldn't work those hours. It's just worth asking the question if it still makes sense given your new context, and choose what makes sense. The third thing that struck me was the point Devdutt makes around phala and bij, what the market wants versus what sort of a seed you are. This is a simple but a very insightful distinction. The only piece I would add here is that often what market wants is quite visible and discernible, but figuring out what sort of a seed you are is a reasonably nebulous and unnerving process. Strangely enough, our education often enables us to process the world outside, but doesn't give us the tools to make sense of the inside world in a meaningful way. I often tell the leaders I work with, instead of asking feedback around strengths and development areas, ask people, given you know me, what sort of a canvas do you think I will thrive in? That's a very different question, which will give you an insight to the kind of seed you are. And if you're grappling with the where to go question, it can provide you with a lot of insights for you to work with. Thank you for listening. If you find the content purposeful, please share with those that could find this valuable, and do also take a moment to rate and leave a review on iTunes. It will help other people discover such content. For more content from leaders like Zia Modi, Vinita Bali, Nandan Nilekani, Vishy Anand, Atul Kasbekar, Amish Tripathi and more, please do visit playtopotential.com. You could access the full conversation or access content that's curated by key themes that might be of interest to you. My next guest is Jay Panda, a member of parliament. In our conversation, we talk about what it takes to succeed in the world of politics and what the business world can learn from it. I look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations at the Play to Potential podcast. Bye now.